ghoulish greetings, everybody. The tunes are courtesy of the lovely Bobby Mackie, and I, of course, am your host, Tessa Morrow.
Scott Jackson had a pregnant girlfriend, Pearl Bryan was her name. He and Alonzo Walling met her at the train. That night the plot unfolded, poor Pearl lost her life. Scott and Alonzo both hung for that crime.
Thanks for stopping by and making Paranormal Prowlers podcast part of your morning, day, night, graveyard shift, whenever you listen and wherever you are listening from Sin City to the City of Angels, from the mountains to the deserts to tropical islands, and you guessed it, everywhere in between, it is absolutely appreciated.
Round of applause. This week's city shout out goes to...
Okay, for sure we are needing the passports for this one. Chisinau, Moldova, Rishon LeZion, Israel, Mayfield, Kentucky, Erbil, Iraq, Shenzhen, China, and Agartala, India. That just happened recently for the first time to my knowledge. Six different countries. Love it. Lighthouses. The ocean's hero. The maritime warrior. The mariner's hero. When one passes a lighthouse, thoughts may cross your mind like, what happened here where this structure had to be constructed to warn people? Shipwrecks? Loss of life? Other sea disasters? Usually that answer is death, yes, yes, and yes. Death, destruction, and despair. Today we find ourselves in the Long Island Sound, and that may sound familiar to some seasoned listeners, as I did an episode back in May of 2022 about Execution Rock's lighthouse, which also calls the Long Island Sound home. But it's not Execution Rock's that we'll be revisiting. No, not today. This is another haunted lighthouse, this one being Race Rock Lighthouse, off the coast of New London, Connecticut. This granite lighthouse, 10,000 tons of granite to be exact, is located on the western end of Fisher's Island. Now, before its existence, there were at least 8 documented shipwrecks that took place in that specific area. The waters, they're choppy, they're unforgiving, and something had to be done before more loss of life occurred. One such event takes place one cold, frigid Thanksgiving day, which I will talk about in just a little while. LighthouseFriends.com talks more about the pre-lighthouse days and talks of a future lighthouse. Quote, in 1852, the Lighthouse Board noted that Race Rock was one of the most dangerous obstructions to navigation on the coast, and that various efforts had been made and numerous appropriations expended in endeavoring to place an efficient and permanent mark near the location. Buoys would often be swept away by the strong currents, and spindles, 2 of which had been sunk 18 inches into the rock, would only last until the breaking up of ice the following spring. The board requested $7,000 to mark Race Rock with some material which will resist the action of the sea and ice, and Congress granted this amount on March 3, 1853. An examination of Race Rock was made in 1854 to determine its character and the proper plan to be adopted in the erection of a beacon thereon. The rock was found to be a large boulder, about 200 feet in diameter, that rested upon a rocky ledge and was covered with just 5 feet of water at low tide. As the rock would not permit a structure of much lateral magnitude, a beacon with the central shaft of iron sunk 4 feet into the rock and topped with a globular iron cage at a height of 20 feet above high water was recommended. Records indicate that this day beacon was completed in 1856, but it was thrown down in 1863 and then temporarily replaced by a first-class iron buoy. Construction begins in 1871 and it would be completed 7 years later in 1878. And it's activated January 1st of 1879. During the time of construction, at some point, a boat that was carrying 200 pounds of gunpowder explodes, killing some of the construction workers. Talk about a major snafu. Other challenges and obstacles and big bumps in the road surfaced as well. Like when it was noticed that the foundation, which consisted of 10,000 tons of large stones weighing up to 5 tons, had vanished. After some diving, it was realized that the foundation was not strong enough as the rocks were tumbling right back into the water. Snafus indeed. Fresno lens originally are what lit this place up. Those are then replaced in 1939 with an oil vapor lens. And that would be replaced in 1978 with a 1,000 watt lamp. I mean, it was just weeks away from the 100 year anniversary that the crews replaced that it becomes automated. Now, if you think this place sounds neat, which, hello, it is, and worthy of a visit, hold up. Stop right there in your tracks, my friends. This is a no-access landmark. Sea mark? I don't know. Some who want a closer look are able to go on a tour boat, but there is no actual access to this island. It's not only trespassing, mind you, but it's extremely dangerous. You could literally breathe your last breath there if you go. So just ask the ships that wrecked. You can't, right? So Race Rock Lighthouse is currently owned and maintained by the New London Maritime Society as part of the National Historic Lighthouse Preservation Act program. The lighthouse was added to the National Register of Historic Places in 2005. One of the shipwrecks that plagued the area, probably the most notorious in the area, was that of the steamship Atlantic. It was 312 feet long with a beam of 36 feet. It weighed 1,112 tons and it carried up to 75 people. I believe this did include crew. So not a lot of people like you see on the cruise ships and what have you, right? But you know, it had an impressive 1,400 horsepower. Ooh, baby. The Atlantic is believed to be the very first steamship to be equipped with gas lighting. And that? Well, it's impressive. This steamship was full of luxury. It provided comfort while spoiling the people on board with fine dining, phenomenal sights of the sea, of course, beautiful suites and staterooms, and saloons. Yeah, please, sign me up. But soon the steamship Atlantic would cease to exist. Patch.com talks about this deadly incident. Quote, North Hill on Fisher's Island is a deceptive place. It is the northwesterly exposure to the island, and while it looks unassuming on a calm, sunny day in July, this location was the scene of one of the worst early maritime disasters in New England. It was the site where the steamship Atlantic was dashed upon the rocks Thanksgiving Day in 1846, killing 42 people. It isn't a deep dive. Drifting down to 30 feet, the bottom is granular sand, and visibility is 10 to 15 feet. As you head to the island, the rocks are exposed in lines that look like battlements for a fortress. The rocks are more numerous as you move into the shore, the sand washed and pulled back into the deeper water. Lobsters dart into their holes, and the black fish can be heard cracking mussel shells in their teeth. Between rocks and the sand openings, I always look for something that would resemble wreckage. For the most part, it is gone, ground up in the rocks, smashed and worn down for more than 160 years. Hurricanes and storms have long finished off a lot of the wreckage, and if you find wooden bits and pieces, you wonder if it isn't a recent relic. It's possible that larger pieces of the wreckage are covered in the sand, which drifts and moves from year to year. Unquote. Now, in this same article, I mean, again, this is an article worth checking out and reading. Again, patch.com, very interesting stuff. But in this same article, they discuss how things quickly go wrong. That ever so fateful and fatal Thanksgiving morning, a day that should have been about being grateful. I mean, I'm grateful every day, obviously. You should too. But being grateful, being with good company, enjoying the views of the water, and having and sharing a finest of feasts, right? But it was anything but turning this holiday into a hellish nightmare that you could not escape. Quote, the Atlantic left the dock just after midnight on the early morning of Thanksgiving Day, November 26, 1846. By the time she was making headway down the Thames River, the weather was turning nasty with a harsh northwesterly wind kicking up faster and faster. The Atlantic made it to the mouth of the river and turned to the west. As the great steamer churned in the howling wind, it drew west toward Bartlett's Reef lightship. Near the reef, there was an explosion on the ship, blowing the boiler and leaving the ship without power. While they tried to maneuver into the wind and keep the waves from hitting them broadside, the steerage lines broke and the giant ship was floundering. The order was given to drop anchors, but the storm was so fierce that they continued moving into the southeast. Over the next few hours, the Atlantic continued to move across the sound in slow, terrifying increments until she was at the shore of Fisher's Island. The article from the Day newspaper commemorating the disaster in November of 1891 described, as she careened toward the shore by the action of the waves, those of her passengers and crew who were over and off the boat at the same time were mostly saved, while those who clung to the boat in her severe tumblings were chiefly lost. The ship was wrecked in the pounding waves that seemed to have crushed and rolled the ship to splinters. A portion of the main shipworks remained, and the infamous bell tolled with the rocking of the vicious sea. That bell would forever be connected with a disaster that took at least 42 lives. The Day article gives the gruesome reports that, quote, some of the victims were found with limbs gone, caused by breaking timbers of the boat. Arms and legs were pinned up on the shores that had been appendages of people not recognizable. When the boat first struck the shore, so powerful was the shock, one of the great boilers broke from its fastenings and went high and dry above the sea. And strange as it may seem, a little boy was found in it alive. When the weather gave way, ships came to the scene of the grisly wreck and brought bodies and survivors alike back to the landing. The wreck of the Atlantic stood as one of the darkest marine disasters to date, with a significant loss of life. Soon stories, like the one mentioned above, begins to circulate. These stories became part of the town and the local myth and folklore. A day after the wreck, Daniel Webster wrote a letter that gave some account of the event and the loss of the captain. He explains in his letter, quote, 22 bodies were brought up here this PM by Mohegan, another ship, which got to the wreck this morning. There were three ladies on board, passengers who were all lost, as were the three chambermaids. Captain Dustin was drowned. No blame seems to be imputed to the captain. The fault is thought to have been in the machinery. Unquote. This became a notable incident in sermons and speech that occurred that year. Eventually, Francis Calkins wrote a stunning poem about the tragedy, further lodging the loss into the hearts and minds of the people of the community. She was a significant conservator of our past. As the bubbles move up the surface and the placid sea comes to view, diving this site is more than just an exploration. It is a quiet and important reflection of what happened here. Climbing up into the boat and taking off my gear, I've immersed myself in a hallowed place. Diving offers reverence to history, where you float and drift like shadows over the rocks and sand that has shaped who we are. From the boat, you can see across to the New London Harbor Light and see Bartlett's Reef. The whole scene unfolds around you. It is tragic, reverential, and ours. Unquote. Again, you should read it in its entirety. There have been some close calls here as well, like one day in April of 1892. LighthouseFriends.com goes into more detail. In April 1892, 24-year-old Christopher Culver, recently appointed head keeper at Race Rock, left his wife and family after a short shore leave in New London to return to the station. R.M. Jerome, a retired sea captain, watched Culver closely as he put off in a 12-foot rowboat, equipped with a cell, to make the 8-mile journey out to the lighthouse. At one point, Jerome saw the boat's cell go down in rough seas and quickly reported that Culver had capsized. A search failed to turn up any sign of the keeper, and several newspapers reported that Culver had drowned. What really happened is that when Keeper Culver realized he couldn't land at the lighthouse, he lowered his cell and rowed to Great Hay Harbor on Fisher's Island and found food and shelter at Mr. Oakley's farm. Amid continuing reports of his death, Culver returned to New London aboard the steamer Munnatucket 2 days after his supposed drowning, and much to the delight of his family and friends, at his 69th wedding anniversary, Culver reminisced about the premature death notice that was published 64 years earlier. The same article shares yet another haunting example when it comes to too close for comfort close calls. In March 1908, Arthur Blish, first assistant keeper of the lighthouse, volunteered to take Adolf Hansen, the second assistant keeper, to Fisher's Island for his shore leave. As the two men approached the island, their small skiff capsized in storm-generated surf, and they were left floundering in the water. Blish, though exhausted, was able to safely reach shore, but Hansen wasn't as fortunate. After being submerged for some time and receiving a severe scalp wound from being dashed against rocks, Hansen lost consciousness. When Blish had recovered somewhat, he managed to wade out into the surf, grab Hansen by the hair of his head, and pull him to safety. Hansen was taken to Fort H.G. Wright on Fisher's Island, where doctors sewed up his head and nursed him back to health. While recuperating, Hansen decided that the risks associated with getting to and from the lighthouse, well, they were just too great, and he resigned his position after just over a month on the job. Adolf Obman of Stamford, Connecticut, was appointed to take Hansen's place and soon reported to the lighthouse. Thomas Carroll. Now, sadly, there was no close call, and too bad that wasn't the case when it came to Thomas Carroll. He, as a child, had survived the Great Irish Famine. It was during that horrible time that Thomas, along with his family, of course, immigrated to the United States from their home in Dublin, Ireland. The Great Irish Famine claimed the lives of over 1 million people and forced 1 million to immigrate. And around 2 million, well, they just took off. Ireland, before this happened, had 8.5 million people. And by 1901, there was only 4.4 million. So sad. And he survived all that, you know? So in 1880, Thomas Carroll begins his career as the Race Rock Lighthouse Keeper. And he was known to row his little boat, like lighthouse keepers before him, from Fisher's Island to Nowanak, where his family lived. And besides family visits, he would also go there to get equipment and supplies and any other things that he needed for the lighthouse. In January of 1885, some counts say 1886, a unforgiving storm comes through the area, and it plagued the area for several days. Thomas was with his family during this time. He knew that his duties were ever so important, could be the difference between life and death, and he could not delay things any longer. Don't get me wrong, of course he enjoyed time with his wife and children, but he had to get back. He knew that, his family knew that. It was time to say goodbye. Storm or no storm, he must go. Now, Thomas Carroll, he's last seen getting in his boat in the choppy waters, and he begins the trek back to Race Rock Lighthouse. He's never seen again. The search for Thomas Carroll is huge. It's extensive, but his body never comes to surface. Lighthouse keeper Carroll left behind his lovely wife and 6 amazing children. Race Rock Lighthouse is believed to be majorly haunted. Just ask the U.S. Coast Guard. They have experienced weird, unexplained happenings here for decades. Some have experienced being touched by a presence that they simply cannot see. Others would hear disembodied footsteps, maybe a name being called out, hearing unexplained sounds. The list goes on. I quote cwesterly.com, see like I see you, not see like in the middle of the sea, which is what you would think, as they talk about some Native American lore that is connected to Race Rock before the lighthouse, before it even existed. According to Native American lore, Race Rock Reef was once an island. Because of the swift currents running up to 6 knots in the race and the sharp rocks that could tear out the bottom of their birch bark canoes, the Indians avoided it. They believed the place was haunted, and as sea levels have risen, the island has disappeared beneath the waves. In colonial times, it was known as Devil Shoal. The same article mentions other paranormal happenings. In 1978, the Coast Guard automated the light, and there have been no crew stationed there for over 40 years. Yet there have been recent reports by boaters of the shadowy figure of a man standing in the tower. He is visible when the light passes over him. Is it Tom Carroll, or one of the victims of the numerous shipwrecks? Speaking of all things that are haunted, Race Rock was in one of Ghost Hunters' earliest episodes, episode 4 of their very first season, where the group had access to this no-access site for 12 hours. You see, the Coast Guard had actually requested this investigation. Some of them were hoping to prove that the location was indeed not haunted, since for years the lighthouse has been rumored to be extremely haunted. So the TAPS team, they were escorted to the island by none other than the Coast Guard themselves. I mean, that's pretty badass, just saying. So members of the Coast Guard have shared that they feel eerie when they are coming or going there. They shared with Ghost Hunters that one time two of the men were just sitting there relaxing, watching some TV, when suddenly they hear the water in the shower going and the sounds of curtains opening and footsteps as if somebody is getting ready to take a shower, right? No one was there except for these two men. I quote ghosthuntersfandom.com as they do talk about the investigation conducted that night by the team. Back at TAPS headquarters, Andy and Brian present their findings to Jason and Grant. Brian and Andy believe that a mist was gradually being thicker as it passed a doorway, but Grant can't see it. The orbs picked up by the infrared cameras can be explained by fog, dust, and other natural phenomena. What can't be explained is what a camera recorded in the attic. Grant gets up and leaves through the only door. Minutes later, his chair abruptly moves on its own, twice. As hard as it is for Jason to admit it, he and Grant report to U.S. Coast Guard Senior Chief Boatswain's Mate Jay Nolda and Boatswain's First Mate Peter Jennings that the lighthouse indeed does appear to be haunted, unquote. Now, something else really interesting happened the night TAPS was there, and it was not paranormal, it was not supernatural, unknown, or unexplained, but an actual rescue was performed by our amazing Coast Guard as they rescued two men who had been stranded on their boat for 5 hours. They were brought to the lighthouse. Wild stuff. Can you imagine if nobody was at the lighthouse that night? I mean, how long would those men have had to stay? I mean, 5 hours already seems like an eternity when you're out at sea and you're just stuck.
And that concludes another fantastic podcast. Legend has it, if you don't tune in, I'll be returning to haunt you. So make sure to tune in for the next episode.
Did you enjoy this week's episode? Listen to the others. They're all awesome. Haven't heard every single one yet? No need to lose a wink of sleep over it, really. You can just hit up any of those awesome podcast platforms such as iTunes, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Deezer, Blueberry. Basically, wherever you may roam to hear your other spooky podcasts, you'll probably find Paranormal Brothers podcast lurking in the background. Thanks, and
I will see you next week.